Welcome to Rough Drafts, How God Writes His Love in Our Stories, a podcast that explores the faith journeys of our friends and neighbors in Burns, Tennessee. Everyone has a story to tell, and in this podcast, we'll hear powerful and inspiring stories of how God works in the ordinary lives of people like you and me. Our stories are unfinished and perfectly imperfect. They are just rough drafts, a glimpse of what is to come because God is still at work, writing plot twists, introducing new characters, and bringing good even from the most challenging circumstances. Join us as we see what God is up to in our stories. Here's your host, Matthew Hyatt.
Friends, this is a special episode again of our Rough Drafts podcast. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks for taking the time to listen. Today, I get to introduce you to someone who I never knew I'd end up being friends with, but it has been so cool. He is a retired professor. He has done all sorts of ministry, and he has written more books than he has read, I think, at this point. I'm not sure. That's not true. He's read way more. He is one of my theology go-tos and history go-tos. He is John Mark Hicks.
Well, it's good to be here, man. It's good to see you.
Usually when we get together, we abuse each other, so.
Yeah, we can continue that practice.
Okay, good. I'd expect nothing less. John, you know, there are Nashville churches and then there are rural churches, and we're in that rural church category. So we don't sometimes know all of the things that are happening with the books getting written in Nashville and the debates and the controversies. So, you know, in Nashville, you need no introduction, but in Dixon, you do a little bit. You have written a ton on communion and on baptism and on how we understand the Bible, hermeneutics, how we understand what women do in church and the history of all of those things.
Long list issue, questions about suffering and identity and formation, those kinds of questions as well.
One of the first times you came out to Dixon for me was to share a little bit about meeting God in the shack.
Right.
And that was a really special night for our folks.
I remember that. I was blessed by it myself. So
I sure was. Well, John, I know some of your stories, but I don't know all of your stories, and I don't know exactly what you want to tell us, but what's your God story for us today?
Well, if I'm going to tell a God story, I'm going to start with what I think is probably the first major God story in my life. God stories come in all forms and sizes and different situations, but the most traumatic is the first. And it was in 1980, my wife of 2 years and 11 months and 10 days or so died in recovery from surgery. She died at home. She was 25, I was 22, and this was 1980. Totally unexpected. It came out of a surgery, and after 10 days of recovery, she had an embolism or a heart clot, blood clot sort of thing. So it was just total surprise. And it kind of divides my life into two sections. The first section, I grew up in Churches of Christ. And I grew up with a father who was a minister and a mother who was a teacher, and so teaching just come by natural.
You had no hope.
I had no hope. I was going to be doing, although I wanted to be a missionary, and that's a form of teaching.
Yeah,
but that was what I wanted to do from my earliest years. I took German in high school and college, and I always envisioned going to Europe and being a missionary in Europe and dedicating myself to that. And making vows to God, you know, this is what I'm going to do, God. You know, I'm going to serve you in this way. And Sheila and I, Sheila was the, you know, I went to college at 16. So everybody in college, none of the girls would date me.
So,
I mean, it's like, you know, something illegal about that, right? I mean, I don't know. You know, the girls would not date me.
You were 16 when you went to college.
Yes.
So are you Sheldon Cooper?
No. He was like 12 or something. Okay, I don't know. You know.
Well, yeah.
I'm not sure about the Big Bang.
Okay. You
know. But finally, someone dated me and I married her. Because I thought, man, this is my shot. But yeah, Sheila and I married. I was 19. She was 22. And I did some education to get prepared for Europe, and And she was on board with it all. And we were, in fact, we had a sponsoring church. We were ready to go and not we had a team. And then we thought, well, we need to correct this problem that she has because we've already had one miscarriage. And the doctors didn't think she could carry full term with her scoliosis. So Emory University Hospital, her doctor there said that, you know, this might be a good time to do that. And we thought the timing was right before we go to Europe. And the surgery went fine, but you know, the recovery, you know, 1980, the recovery was very different than these days. And blood clots were always a concern. But we didn't realize that it would end up like that, of course.
No.
So it was a shock. It was a shock. Now, see, I'm thinking all this time, you know, from the age of 12, when I really had a consciousness about being a preacher and being a missionary, from the age of 12 to the age of 22, for those 10 years, I had this sense that God and I had a deal, right? I'm going to do this for you. You're going to do this for me. I don't know if I would have expressed it that way at the time.
It might would have felt a little wrong to say out loud, but it was the thinking behind it.
But it was kind of, it was the feeling. It was the gut, you know, that God's going to bless me if I leave everything and go for God. Then God will yield a hundredfold, you know, kind of thing. So it's like I had these expectations of God because of the level of commitment. I had these expectations, almost a quid pro quo sort of thing. I'll do this and you do that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a mechanistic understanding of God.
Yeah.
Kind of reward punishment understanding of God.
I think that's really common.
Yeah. I grew up in that kind of, I got it from somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, I learned that somewhere. And I think it is part of culture in a lot of conservative churches to kind of think that way. Not just Churches of Christ, but across the board.
It's funny. It's almost a sister or cousin to some of the prosperity gospel that we were so strongly against.
Yeah.
But it was, if you are good, good things happen. Mm-hmm. Read Proverbs. Isn't
right.
that what Proverbs says?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, the generalizations in Proverbs can give you that feel. And although Ecclesiastes stands on the other end of that, that it doesn't always work out.
Yeah.
But I had this expectation. I mean, my life up to that point had been filled with joy. You know, I can only remember going to one funeral and never went hungry, never had, you know, I had a surgery that, if I had had that surgery, it would have killed me eventually, but it was removal of a cyst, but that didn't seem all that big a deal to me, you know? So life was good, and I was enjoying life, and I was enjoying my marriage, and enjoying my studies, and we had this hopeful future in mind. And we thought, why in the world wouldn't God bless that?
Mm-hmm.
Almost like, God ought to bless that.
Yeah.
You know, he should bless that. I mean, if God doesn't bless that, something wrong with God, right? You know,
yeah.
That kind of thing. But that was, again, as I look back on it, I can see that's kind of the world I was living in, though I wouldn't have necessarily articulated it that way at the time.
Right.
It's part of growth and part of transformation that you see where you came from and what has led you to this point and the sorts of things you think about and reflect on is part of transformation. So when she died on April the 30th, 1980, I was just totally crushed. And the crushing experience is certainly the loss that I had not expected. And it was also a crushing experience in sense of what happened to our deal?
Yeah.
You know, the kind of, I felt betrayed by God. I was never angry at Sheila. I was never angry like, why'd you die on me? I mean, sometimes people have those feelings and I understand that.
Right.
But I didn't have that feeling. I wasn't mad at her. Because we prayed about that, right? We prayed that it would be successful and that we'd be able to have children and we would be able to go to Europe and we're going to do this for God. And, you know, God's got to like that.
Yeah. What's not to like?
Yeah, what's not to like about that? So I was mad at God. And I felt a deep sense of betrayal. So much so that my anger towards God meant that I didn't talk to God for 9 months. I did not talk to God. Now, I had all those feelings inside, but I wasn't telling anybody.
Okay, I was about to ask, you know, were you going through the motions at church, doing churchy things?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I was preaching on occasion, you know. Let's see, after she died, I started preaching about regularly about 6 months after that in North Philadelphia. And I was still doing this struggle inside. So I was living a double-minded life.
Yeah.
Because internally I was angry, but externally I was playing the hero. Which is part of family systems, you know, what role do you play in your family? Yeah. Well, and I grew up playing the hero. I mean, I was the young preacher boy following his dad. And so I was kind of the exemplary, devout, knowing the Bible, answering the Bible questions, you know.
Oh, you were writing Bible study guides.
Well, yeah, when I was in high school, I wrote... we had a little study group that had Pentecostals, Baptists, and just diverse group at the school. And we would have a meeting once a week. And so we got into discussions of charismatic and healings. And one of the person in the group was blind. And, you know, so we had a lot of discussions about charismata and gifts. And so I developed my own little study guide. It turned into a book that was published, you know, I think it was published when I was 16, but I wrote it when I was like 14, and it got published because some minister came through our home and saw it and said, oh, can I publish that? You know, when you're 15 years old, you say, no.
yeah, right.
You say, whoa, you want to publish that? Really? Wow, thank you. You know, go ahead.
Yeah.
Now I burn them, but, you know, it's not that bad.
But not the, not the minister, the book, just to clarify.
I do try to buy them out when I see something, you know.
Kind of makes me want to get my hands on one of these illicit books.
You want to find, it's mainly because of the picture on the back. The picture on the back is like, it's my senior picture at 16.
So, John, you know I'm going to have to find
He's a really, really a dorky looking person there, you know.
That's going to have to be the cover picture for this podcast.
Oh, there you go. Well, go for it. You know, go for it. See if you can find it.
Yeah, see if you can find it. That's the gauntlet you're
throwing. I know it's in a few libraries, like Fried Hardeman or Lipscomb.
Okay, well, and what's the Dewey Decimal number on those?
I can check them out and...
You'll interlibrary loan it so that none of them will exist in the Southeast. Okay. So this is a sea change moment for you because it was a loss that was hard in and of itself, but it was also a loss of a system with God.
Right, right. So it's a systemic change that I didn't realize was changing.
Yeah.
Right? Because I was mad at God because I had that systemic understanding that God is operating in this way in the world. So if God is operating in this quid pro quo way, why did this happen?
I paid my quid. Where's my quo?
Yeah, you know? Right. There you go. Where's the reward, you know? And not thinking even in so much about, not even thinking so much about reward, but thinking about where's the blessing? Yeah. Where's God's companionship in this? Where's God's encouragement in this, you know? Am I supposed to give up on this goal in life?
Yeah.
Give up on missions? And
how am I supposed to do this with my partnership here?
What am I going to do now? And I didn't know what to do after she died. I mean, the funeral was, like I said, it was really the first funeral I had a personal invested stake in. So I didn't I didn't know how you do this. Yeah. You know, I never conducted a funeral, and you know. So when that happened, it was in North Georgia. In North Georgia, you sit with you sit with the person.
Yeah.
You spend like 2 days sitting with the body in the funeral home and receiving visitors all day. And that was just torture for me. I had no desire to do that, but I was doing it because it was culturally...
It's what everyone did.
Yeah, it was just culturally acceptable. And of course, her mom and dad were hurting and her brothers were hurting. So doing what was good for them is also part of that.
Right.
But yeah, that, you know, the funeral is also, I have memories of moments of embarrassment. I mean, the part of the practice, I don't know if this is generally true in North Georgia, but part of the practice in my situation was everybody leaves the building at the end of the funeral and the family has a moment alone, right, with the casket, with the body.
Kind of one final viewing.
Yeah, one final viewing. And then you close it up and then you walk out of the building.
Yeah.
Now, I was just following directions because I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And when I walk out the building, I'm being carried by my brother. And I'm weak with grief and I can't hardly walk. And so I'm kind of hanging on them, my brother and one of Sheila's brothers. And I walk out that door, and the whole church is out there. I mean, the whole community is out there. And I was shocked to see them. I thought they were dissipating. I thought they were going away. And so I was totally embarrassed by my condition of grief. And I can remember thinking, well, I'm never going to let this happen again.
Mm.
You know? And so it set me up for... In dealing with grief, the avoidance of embarrassment, which meant I didn't talk about it much, and I internalized it, and I covered it over, and I said, I'm supposed to be the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I approached my grief in those early years. I'm the hero. I got to be strong. So I can't break down.
Yeah.
You know? But internally, I was broken. I was so broken internally. I was rebellious, and because I was angry with God. And that turned, that anger stayed a long time. But it turned in a helpful or a healing way, though it was a long path to healing. It turned when a friend of mine said, "Well, John Mark, why don't you?" Why don't you read the Psalms? And on the outside, I'm saying, oh, thank you for that advice. On the inside, I'm saying, who do you think you are? You know, telling me to read the Psalms.
Yeah.
I got two master's degrees. I'm in a doctorate program. And I'm a Fried Hardeman graduate. You know, I know the Psalms.
I wrote some of them.
I've read them before.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing all that inside. Yeah. On the outside, I'm going, oh, well, thank you.
Thank you, brother.
And I can't even remember who that was.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, I don't remember who that was. But somebody said that to me. And finally, I got desperate enough. And it was out of desperation that I said, okay, I'm going to read the Psalms. And kind of like, I've done this before. I know some of these songs pretty well. Okay, I'll start reading day one, one psalm a day. And I think what had changed is I was reading with different eyes.
Mm-hmm.
When I read the Psalms before, I was reading as a part of this system that I had earlier that is now broken. That system's broken because I've been betrayed, right? So who is this God?
Yeah.
I mean, a line from C.S. Lewis, A Grief Observed, which I read during this period, I remember the line in A Grief Observed where he says something like, I don't think this is the exact quote, but something like, I never ceased believing in God, but I did wonder what kind of God I had.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
That's a powerful work.
Yeah. Oh, it's a powerful, yeah, it's a beautiful work that you can see the internal stuff going on. And that was me, but I wasn't expressing it anyway.
Right.
Not externally. So I started reading the Psalms, and then you get to Psalm 6. How long, O Lord? And my anguish, the anguish in my soul. I go, oh, yeah, I know what that means. You know? And then Psalm 10. Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? And I'm going, yeah, why do you? You know? And then I get to Psalm 13. How long, O Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long must I have sorrow in my heart every day? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look at me. Consider me. You know, give light to my eyes that I may not sleep in death or sleep the sleep of death. And I thought, I can pray that. Mm-hmm. That I can pray. And when reading the Psalms, I said, okay, I can do this. I have permission to pray that.
Yeah.
It's in the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, it's the voice of Israel. And so I just started praying the lament Psalms.
Okay.
And that's how I got back into praying, is praying the lament Psalms. It was, I didn't have words because I didn't want to talk to God.
Yeah.
And I was fearful that I would choose the wrong words. You know, that I might commit the blasphemy against the Holy Spirit. You know, don't want to do that. Can't be forgiven of that one. You know, so I'm not going to pray. It's better to not pray than to do that.
Okay.
That was kind of, I mean, that's irrational in some ways.
I see the logic to it, though.
Yeah.
I mean, in the system you're in, it made sense.
But it's confused.
Right.
You know, it's a really confused understanding. But that's kind of that fear of saying the wrong thing to God.
And even expressing the right thing to God runs counter to what you learned. I don't want to feel the embarrassment. I don't want to. Somewhere you learned that tears are bad. Tears are shameful.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's part of playing the hero, right? Mm-hmm. Is you avoid the tears and you avoid the sadness. And that was because of that 12-year-old self or wherever that came from. It's been a struggle my whole life up until about 16 years ago or so that struggled to deal with that grief. It was always there. It was always, I get triggered into it and then I try to cope with it and the coping was not always done very well. And you know, acting out instead of actually facing the grief.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a long life struggle. But what I learned by reading the Psalms and by praying those Psalms is, wow, this God is not a quid pro God. This God is a relational God.
Yeah.
And the big shift for me was from this system, what might be included in that system, you know, particular understandings of grace or particular understandings of law or particular understandings of reward or, you know, whatever was a part of that system, which I not only bought into but taught and based my life on, right? That system broke down by reading the Psalms and reading Job and reading Ecclesiastes, all of which became important in my own life development. That God is interested in communion and relationship, and I know those are buzzwords today, but that's what I learned in 1980.
Yeah,
you know, 80, 81, 82, that communion and relationship and things. God doesn't make any absolute promises about what your life is going to look like, and that we have to understand we're in a journey with God, and that God does work in ways through trials and through hurts and through pains to form us and to test us. I believe that there's a testing of God, a probing of God. There's kind of a heart surgery. And I think that what I learned about myself, and this wouldn't be true of everybody who has this sort of thing experience, but I learned, you know, I had a lot of pride back in that. I'd play into hero. There was a pride in that. There was a pride in being a Fred Hardiman Bible major, you know.
Yeah.
There's a pride in being, you know, having two master's degrees, and there's a pride in being a missionary, and maybe even there's a pride in thinking, okay, I'm going to be a missionary, then maybe I'll come back and teach or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure if that was in my head totally, but I imagine it was, that it probably do some education over in Europe and come back. But I don't know how explicit that was. I can't remember that. But that pride translated into kind of approval seeking.
Mm-hmm.
I need approval. I need my dad's approval. I need my professor's approval. I need my church's approval. I need God's approval. So I'm going to do this to get approved.
Mm.
Right? And that was the center of my theological formation before Sheila died. After Sheila died, honestly, I can look back, and there were moments when I looked back and said, all that was scuba, you know, all that was junk.
Mm-hmm.
That set me up for this.
Yeah.
Set me up for a depth of grief that is not good, you know, not fair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the movement beyond that is one of transformation, of seeing God through the lens of fundamentally desiring communion and relationship and the love, coming out of the love of God. So this is the strange thing. My experience of grief taught me in more fundamental and more profound ways that God loves me.
That sentence sounds insane.
It does sound insane. And if I hadn't experienced it, I would think it was insane.
Yeah.
But that's exactly where it took me. That God is not on this punishment-reward system or prosperity, poverty system, but that God is in love with me, and God loves me in such a way that God is going to form me and lead me and guide me, not into greatness and stuff that I can have pride in, but God is going to form me in ways that I can come to know God. And it was through grief that I came to know God. I don't think I really knew God before that. Now, was I saved? Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, I was a prideful person and heroic sort of person. Even though people tell me that's not how they saw me back then, but I'm thinking about my own heart, and I'm sure it was tempered in some ways. And I think even in that situation, God's gracious to me. If I'd have died at 16, I don't think it would have been a problem.
Right.
But I didn't see grace as the center of things, and I didn't see the love of God as the center of things. Did I talk about it? Sure.
Yeah.
You know, of course. But now, what is the center of the system?
Mm.
And the center of the system before Sheila died for me was mechanistic. It was a mechanism. It was a way of doing things. It was a way of being that meant God is going to work with me and repay me, and I pay God, and He repays me, and God, you know, that kind of system. So you have to work the system.
Right.
You know, do the steps. You know, work the system. But that shifted from, from that to God's transforming love through grief. And I began to see God more at the center of the world in my life as the one who is inviting me into loving communion. It became a relational center. Over here, it's mechanistic, but it became relational.
So Psalms helped you make that turn.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What else helped you make that turn in thinking? Because not everybody who experiences traumas like that comes out amazed and empowered by the love of God. I mean, there are a lot of sad stories of people who come out fully embittered. I know that's kind of an impossible question, but what helped?
No, I mean, that's a good question because my experience is not everybody's experience.
Right.
And for some people, that kind of trauma destroys whatever confidence they had in God in the first place, if they had any.
Right.
You know? So it prevents them from knowing God, you know, in their experience. So I understand that. It's different. So a couple of things. I think that's a good question. One is, you know, Job also had a big impact on me. Because mm-hmm. when I read the Lament Psalms and I started reading Job, I said, you tell him, Job. go. You know, that's right, you know. When Job says, I will never see happiness again, I'm thinking, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, I won't see happiness again.
Yeah.
That's in chapter 7. But that lament in chapter 7, or that lament in chapter 3, where Job says, I wish I'd never been born. I know exactly how that feels.
Yeah.
I wish that, you know, this is such a horrible experience. I wish I'd never been born. Or I wish you'd just go ahead and kill me, God. You know. And then Job, about the middle of Job, in the dialogues about chapters 12, 13, or 14, Job moves from, kill me, get this over with, to, oh, before you kill me, explain this to me.
Yeah.
You know, I want my day in court, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. So Job helped me as well in terms of the ability to speak my mind, speak my heart, which is kind of a strange thing that we can't tell God how we feel. God already knows how we feel.
Isn't it a shame we can't tell God the truth?
Yeah. And when God already knows the truth.
Right.
It's kind of like, well, you know, you're going to put on a smiley face for God. I mean,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, you think this is going to work?
Yeah.
It feels...
But, you know, in those moments of grief, I don't want to tell God, you know.
Well, there's this kind of performative aspect. We think we owe God a performance. And
yeah, sure. So we're going to perform even for God in that context, right? So I think, and the ending of Job became really powerful for me, that when God shows up and gives grace to Job, I don't think God's slapping Job around. I think God is being the wise sage, the kind of parental figure who says, Job, now you really know what you're talking about?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think he's yelling at him. I don't think he's beating him up. I think he's reminding him what Job already knows.
It feels almost playful to me.
Yeah, it can.
You know, where were you when I hung the moon, you know?
Right.
Do you know how the balance between the oceans work?
You think you could do a better job, Job?
Really?
You
know,
in chapter 40? You think you can do a better job?
I kind of just imagine God smiling when he asks those questions, and Job sort of saying,
look at the world. Can you control the Leviathan and the behemoth?
You draw him out with a hook.
Yeah,
You go fishing, catch one of those guys.
Exactly.
We don't even know what they are, and you know.
And then Job, in my understanding of Job 42:6 is that Job says, "Okay, I relent. I don't know everything. I'm ignorant. Your works are too wonderful for me to even understand. And I relent. I give up my complaint, and I am comforted." I think that's what Job 42:6 says.
Yeah.
Now, it's not what your Bibles will typically say.
Most of them put the word repent there,
right, repent,
they?
Which and is not the Hebrew word for repent.
No, it's not a great translation.
It's a word, a Hebrew word that means change of mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've changed. I've changed from what?
Yeah.
I think Job has changed from lament and accusation, protest, to comfort.
Yeah.
And the comfort is the presence of God. So I think Job has been, that was a big one for me. And then another is the Gospels, the story of Jesus.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, I think you've heard of him.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. The story of Jesus who undergoes suffering, who is tempted, who knows what it's like to be human, who is willing, who is able to lament himself, you know, from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? The story of Jesus gives me reason to trust God. Because God didn't give Jesus a rose garden.
Right.
It gave him a cross. And the incarnation, the empathetic nature of the incarnation, that Jesus understands us, you know, that sort of thing. So Jesus understands my grief, and yet Jesus is willing to trust. So I think of the cross particularly through the lens of lament. He's lamenting what's happening in that moment.
Yeah.
But he's also trusting God in that moment. Remember, the words at noon are, my God, why have you forsaken me? Psalm 22. But the words of the final cry in Luke are, into your hands I commit my spirit.
Right.
Which comes from a trust psalm.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I think that story gave me the confidence, kind of the desire to see myself in that story of lament and trust and God's ultimate goal is restoration, right, and healing. So in the ministry of Jesus, Jesus is healing. We don't heal everybody, and Jesus doesn't get healed himself
right,
until the resurrection. Right. So those would be, you know, Psalms, Job, story of Jesus. And there are particular other texts like Romans 5 or Hebrews 12 that factor in there strongly. But the stories of the lament psalms and Job and Jesus are kind of the big ones for me.
Yeah, those are powerful texts. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't grow up with a whole lot of the wisdom literature that I wasn't really trained on how to preach that. I barely know how to read those. You know, poetry we struggle with just in general. But that's such a big section of the Bible that kind of gets neglected. And I feel like sort of counterbalance each other in an interesting way. You know, I mentioned earlier Proverbs with kind of an overgeneralization and a misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Proverbs sort of sounds like the you do good, you get good, the mechanistic view of God. But then you get to Ecclesiastes, and a friend of mine likes to say, Hebel happens, you know. The race does not always go to the swift, the battle to the strong.
It do.
Stuff sometimes happens. And and then you kind of get Job's story, which is just even weirder. I mean, I like to kind of sarcastically describe it as the time God and the devil made a bet about a guy. And then you get the Psalms, which are embracing every aspect of these and then some, praise from the mountain, praise from the valley.
Right, pray in the cave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Those are great resources because they do bring diverse angles into play. You know, when you're thinking Proverbs, you're thinking, how do you live with God's wisdom in an ordered universe?
Yeah.
You know, what's the best way to live within the order? I mean, if you try to fit a square peg in a round hole, it's going to break.
Right.
Right. So if you live within God's order, typically it's going to...
It works better.
I think in general, you know, in general, you don't step out in front of a bus, you know, kind of thing.
It doesn't usually work great.
Right. Yeah. But even Proverbs recognizes these are not absolute rules.
Right.
These are general guidelines about living within order because disorder invades. In Ecclesiastes, Hebel happens, you know, disorder invades. And we see that disorder being poured out on Job, you know.
Yeah.
And then the Psalms, half of the Psalms are disoriented.
Yeah.
Whether it's sin or disease or enemies or whatever it is, we live in a lot of disorientation because it's not all working the way we thought it should, even when we're betrayed, like Psalm 69.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but the resources are there because I think part of the point of Job is this is how faith endures. Job never curses God, but he has bitterness, he has anger, he's protesting, he's got questions, but that's how faith endures.
Yeah.
faith doesn't endure by silencing ourselves. It doesn't endure by withdrawing and isolating and performing. You know, it didn't work for me. Performing didn't work for me. You know? So we learn how to practice our faith in the midst of lament by reading Job and by reading some of these Psalms of lament.
So you described life as kind of being in two epochs, the before the loss of Sheila, the after. Mm-hmm. And the things that you learned in those years after her passing are significant, but life has not been easy since then.
No, it hasn't. I remarried and married a woman who had a daughter, and we had a son named Joshua, and then we had another daughter. And Joshua had a genetic terminal condition, and he died at 16 in 2001. So, I mean, there have been other struggles too, but that, of course, was a major event in our lives. We watched him basically die over 10 years, slowly deteriorating and in so many ways. And all the grief triggers come up again. And my lament came up again. My anger with God came up again. So it wasn't like, oh, I went through 9 months of anger. Oh, no, I'm done.
Yeah.
No. I mean, that gets triggered.
So how is it different the second time? And I know it's not the second time. I know there are traumas between A and B. But, you know, how was it different experiencing it? It was still real. It was still painful. Yeah. I'm not trying to insinuate anything that minimizes it or maximizes it.
No, I get that.
How was that experience different from a different perspective? I don't even know what to ask here. How was it different?
I wasn't living in that old system anymore. I was in a new world, a new way of relating to God. And so lament was natural. The anger was still there because the questions, I still have questions.
Yeah.
The questions aren't answered. They still haven't been answered, and I don't expect them to be answered. God didn't answer Job's questions.
Right.
So, but the lament came naturally because of the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, and I could ask the questions without fear. I could ask the questions without wondering, should I be saying that or not? And I wasn't holding it. Yeah. Now, I still had a lot to learn. And ultimately, about 15, 16 years ago, I came to a point where I had to finally, dramatically, and fully deal with the grief. And since that time of therapy and work and relationships, I'm in a much better place last 15, 16 years than I was.
It is
previously.
Kind of neat to hear you say something that was under that sentence, though. Your theology, your understanding of God, helped you through the second loss differently. But even with a healthier theology, there was still a grief that had to be processed and dealt with.
Yeah.
And I like hearing people say that because I do think sometimes in church we have accidentally, maybe even intentionally, given the impression that if you get your God stuff together, all this stuff ain't hard.
Right.
And that's just not true.
Yeah, I mean, if you go from like 1980 to 2008, you know, that's 28 years of processing grief. And 2008 is when I'm thinking, okay, this is when I made a big turn you know, of healing. So I would say from 1980 to 2008, I was not healed.
Yeah.
I talked like I was.
Yeah. Performed.
You know, and I put on the performance, you know, in a lot of ways. And none of that was necessarily intentional performance in terms
it,
of...
It doesn't make you a charlatan.
Yeah. No, it wasn't a charlatan. It was just, I didn't fully understand.
Yeah.
You know, I understood some things, like praying the Psalms and lament. That's a good thing. I mean, that's one thing. So I understood some things, but it wasn't fully integrated into me, you know, not until around 2008. So it takes time. I mean, we've got to give people time for this. And we got to give them space to lament, space to be angry, space to be doubters and questioning. And if we don't give them space, then we'll just push them away.
The takeaway from our conversation about the shack 10 years ago, whenever that conversation was, I remember you saying, it's not my job to defend God. He can do that himself. I don't have to defend God to you in your grief. And that was, I don't even know if you remember saying that.
No, I don't remember saying it. But it sounds good.
Good. You still agree with you. You know, but that was.
I'm glad you remember it.
Well, it was significant because I think there is an impulse in a lot of us that we have to fix it for people.
Yeah.
And we rush to God's aid and he doesn't need our defense.
What God needs is for us to be a presence, to be with people and to share their grief and to share their questions.
Yeah.
Not critique them for their questions. You know, why are you asking God that question?
Yeah.
Now, people have sometimes said, you shouldn't ask why. And you should say, not why me, why not me? Yeah, and I understand where that comes from. It comes from a place of, you know, this junk happens to everybody, you know. And so why shouldn't it be me? It happens to everyone. So I can see that. But when you turn that, we make it a converse and say, well, you shouldn't say then, why me? Why now?
Yeah.
Why this? Well, that's just what the Bible does.
Yeah. Yeah, Bible, you have a problem with some
Jesus did that, right? Yeah. Why have you forsaken me? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not inappropriate to ask why. And so when someone's doing that in the funeral home, or they're doing that in your home, or they're doing that in the church lobby, don't critique the question.
Yeah.
Understand where the question's coming from and know that faithful people for centuries, going at least back to the Hebrew Bible and the Psalms, have been doing that very thing.
Yeah.
And it's not an affront to God. It's not an offense to God. It's rather God, the Psalms are God's invitation to enter into that space.
Yeah.
So that we can use that language ourselves.
The people we trust the most, we are the most honest with. If I can't trust you, I won't open myself up to you.
Right.
What does it say about how little sometimes we trust God based on the way we're unwilling to open ourselves?
Right. And God already knows anyway.
And it's just so silly. It's so silly when you say it like that.
But it's real.
Yeah.
It's real for so many people. It's real for me. You know, for 9 months, I didn't talk to God because I just afraid I would say something I shouldn't say.
Yeah,
you know.
My small group is reading The Shack. It's a new group since the last time you were down here. When I first read The Shack, I didn't have kids yet.
Mm.
It's different with your own kids.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I'm thoroughly enjoying this read through, and you probably heard it in a comment I made earlier, is how playful Papa is with Mac. How playful Jesus and Sarah, you are, you know, they know.
Yeah.
They know. And every time he starts to do something and he acts like they don't know what they're doing. My favorite scene, one of my favorite scenes, is when he goes to the meal and he starts to bow his head to pray. And then he looks up and they're all looking at him and he goes, thanks, I guess. Just those moments.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, I like the spirit of The Shack because it does show us, it gives us a view of God that is deeply relational and fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's fun. They will run across the water together, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. There's a joy.
Yeah.
It's not just happiness, like, oh, I got something I like.
Yeah.
But there's a deep joy.
Joy of relationship.
Yeah. Between the Father, Son, and Spirit, this deep sense of mutuality and joy. That they want to share with Mac. They want Mac to participate and become part of the joy of their relationship.
Do you remember the scene where they wanted to have, where the Trinity is going to have devotion? They're sitting at the dinner table, and the narrator tells you, you know, Mac is thinking about, you know, are we going to pull out the old dusty Bible and ask Bible questions?
Or,
and it goes back to scenes of his childhood where he got yelled at for getting the answers wrong. And then Jesus turns to Papa and just starts saying, I thank you for the way you did these things. What you did was beautiful today. And so then in our small group, we voted on one of our couples and made them practice a devotion to each other.
Oh,
it was beautifully awkward and hilarious, but it was kind of a neat moment still. Just what would life be like if we were vulnerable, transparent?
And we were affirming of each other rather than suspicious of one another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This has been rich.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it, Matthew. Appreciate the invitation to be a part.
I wish we had another 4 hours because I'd like to talk to you about Anchors for the Soul or Women Serving God or
Maybe
Searching for
time.
The Pattern. You know, we'll do a whole series.
Whenever you want to get in trouble, just let me know.
Well, I spend most of my life in trouble. But without going too far down that road, what I think is so neat about those, even embracing creation, you share stories of, here is how I understood God, but in my continued growth, development, maturation, study, experience, whatever ingredients there are, here are things that I understand differently today. And I appreciate the way that you're able to do that without condescending the old position, without berating, without even feeling guilt for what I used to do or used to think. It's, I want to serve God to the best of my ability today.
Yeah, that's a good point. Not feeling guilt. I mean, I was doing the best I could with what I had. And I believe God accepts that, you know, even though it's very flawed and very broken at times. If I'm seeking God, seeking the will of God, God accepts that. So I have a large sense of grace, I think, for people all along the path who are searching for God. And I think that my experience with Sheila's death and that struggle for that 9 months or so relieved me of some fear of change. I changed systems from what I'd known up to when I was 22 years old to a new journey and a new way of relating to God that has been part of my life since I was 22.
Yeah.
And so I had that was a huge shift right there.
Yeah.
And if I had fear of change, that would have never happened.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, I'm going to change. No, I was kind of forced to change. If I were going to stay in relationship with God, I had to have a new way of understanding God, because the old way of understanding God it didn't work.
You didn't hold water.
And it created struggles, and it wasn't true.
Yeah.
You know? So seeking that new relationship gave me a sense of, I'm not afraid to change.
Yeah.
If the story of Scripture leads me to that change.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that, I think that's an important part of my study in life.
Well, John, is there anything else you want to share today?
I think I've shared enough for people to chew on, maybe.
You've shared plenty for me to chew on.
Yeah. So
you made me want to
go
pick up
Psalms again today.
We'll
leave another time to chew on some other things if you want to.
You know, I'll say this. I grew up, Dan Winkler was one of my ministers growing up, and he was an important voice in my life, and I learned a lot from him. And when he went through the tragedy that he went through with his son, the first time I ever heard him preach about that, the thing that he said was, live in Psalms. That was the only advice he gave, live in Psalms.
Wow, that's wonderful advice.
And
that was a horrible tragedy he experienced.
As a person who struggles with Psalms sometimes, when I hear you and I hear him and I hear others do it, I think, man, I've got to figure out how to elevate this wisdom literature in my life and in our church.
I would suggest read a good contemporary, easy to read translation.
Yeah,
that gives you contemporary voice to the Psalms rather than some older translation that might be like you're singing a 19th century hymn or something. You know,
verily, verily,
that sort of thing.
So, I thoroughly enjoyed The Voice. Did you read The Voice in the Psalms?
No, I haven't read The Voice, so I don't know about that.
They really focused on the artistry of the Psalms. It took some criticism, but it was.
But read something contemporary like that as a way of getting into it, and Now, there's still some things that are difficult in the song.
Yeah.
And so it's not easy reading in every respect.
Blessed are the ones who dash your babies against the rocks.
Yeah, well, you know, Psalm 137 is one of those that's very difficult, the ending of it.
I keep asking to preach that on Mother's Day. Nobody's ever said yes.
Oh, man. I'm going to leave that one alone.
Oh, man. Well, John, this has been really good. And if you didn't take anything else from today, John said that if you want some heaven points, God will owe you if you read the book of Psalms and everything will turn out better. or maybe it was the exact
that
opposite.
The summary?
I'm not real good at this.
Oh, you haven't been listening.
I get that a lot. Sound like Leslie now. Okay. Well, friends, hey, thank you so much
for
listening today.
Good to be here.
John has a website that I'll link in the show notes. It has some really cool Bible studies through Job, links to some teaching that he's doing through Hebrews right now.
Right.
Just some cool stuff. I appreciate John's heart and his scholarship. And I appreciate you for taking the time to listen to this. There's a lot of things you could have listened to today, but you chose this, and I'm honored that you'd trust us with an hour of your time. Till next time, I can't wait to hear what God writes in your story.
Thanks for listening to Rough Drafts. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. While you're at it, help us spread the word by leaving a rating and review. Until next time, let's keep looking for how God writes His love into our stories.